Good evening, dear friends. Welcome to our Tuesday Sangha Dharma Talks. We have one of these on the first Tuesday of each month. This is, October 3rd, I think, somehow. Enjoyed a very lovely, hard rain earlier tonight. As soon as it started raining, there was a flurry of activity at the back door, and my youngest child and two friends came running inside, soaked but very happy. And so just carrying that image with me tonight of that delight and that excitement. Last month, when we talked about the seven factors of awakening, and on the retreat, Barbara shared about the Brahma Vihara, the four immeasurable, or the four minds of love. And one of the words that comes up and really sparks a lot of engagement around the practices of equanimity. And equanimity is one of those that one of those practices that looks really lovely, something to aspire to, just nice balance all the time. And and it's also one that can be easily misinterpreted. I remember coming back from a 10-day retreat, and I was feeling very, equanimous. and everything just felt really smooth and easy. And I was home for like 3 or 4 days, and my wife said, "Where are you?" And in my mind, I was like, well, I'm equanimous. I'm right here, totally fine. But what one of the things that she was picking up on, and I think it's really easy to slip into, is that indifference, kind of a cool remove. It's not so much that she wanted me to be reactive. Rather, she was looking for that kind of that connection, that part of equanimity that is very easy to look over. It's very easy to move into that indifference, that cool remoteness, which can feel great at times, but it's not really connected to other people or to the world around. And the Brahma Viharas, those four minds, they're mentioned in the five mindfulness trainings twice, and we've talked about them here, but it's that loving kindness and compassion and joy, or sometimes it's sympathetic joy, that is the joy in seeing others joyful, and then equanimity. And those are actually old practices. They predated Buddhism and the Buddha. But they were used more for social engagement. So just kind of how to get along with everybody, how to be nice. And the Buddha took those and probed a little bit deeper, wanted to use them as practices for awakening, practices for ending suffering. And so equanimity is a powerful practice of engagement. It's not a passive, cool remove, but it's rather a full engagement while at the same time not being as reactive. Another way of thinking about it is when you're feeling equanimity, you're being very responsive to the world, to others around you, but you're not reacting to that response. I imagine there were many times when the Buddha was working with the Sangha, and he developed quite a robust community that continues until today. And every time something came up, they added a new precept into the monastic order. So there's like 240 for the monks and over 300 for nuns. But they were developed to help sustain a healthy community. But I imagine there were times where he was frustrated, where there was a monk who was quite ill, and they had a precept about not eating after noon. And this monk wasn't able to eat, but by the evening had his appetite back and needed some nourishment, and the monks didn't feed him. Because they said, no, no, we have this precept that says, don't feed, we don't eat after noon. And so imagine the Buddha heard that, and he took it in and probably had a response to it, like, oh, there's some rigidity here. There's some, and so created a new precept that if you were sick, it was okay to eat after noon. And things like that just kept emerging. And so he had to handle and work with those elements of human nature. But what he didn't do was kind of wildly react to things. He didn't chastise or yell at the monastics for not feeding him. He was very understanding about what was happening. And I think it's a wonderful model for our lives, too, to let the world touch us, to let our experience be our experience, and then to let it go. And I think of it like if you were to pour sand through your hand, the sand touches your hand, and then it runs through your fingers. So you make contact with it, but you don't hold on to it. And if you try to hold on to it, it just kind of makes a mess and gets all stuck in your fingers. And you just take your hand away, and then nothing touches it. Probably doesn't have any reactivity because nothing's touching it, but it also has no connection, no engagement. Thich Nhat Hanh changed the word equanimity in the translations. The word is upeksha in Sanskrit, or upekka in Pali. So I guess you have some flexibility with how you choose to translate it. And he chose the word inclusiveness to capture this idea of connection. Rather than just kind of letting things pass over you without tipping in either way, he thought of it as including everything, including it all. All of our experience, all of the difficulty and joy in the world, and then not reacting to it. It's a very noble pursuit, one that is easy to not do. It can be a hard practice to do, to really let things in and to just watch our response to it without then feeling the need to react from it. So resting in that space between stimulus and response or reaction. One of the reasons for using the word inclusiveness in thinking about equanimity is that all day long our mind is parsing things, taking things apart and putting them into categories. I like this, I don't like this. I want more of that, I don't want any more of that. It's all day, it's kind of navigating that space. It's really doing its job. It's part of our survival, and it's part of just how we understand the world. Like if we couldn't discriminate between, you know, a door and a wall, it would be a little awkward. So the mind is doing that all day, and the invitation that equanimity offers us is to relax that discriminative thinking a little bit, to not saying like, okay, this I'm going to hold on to, this I'm going to push away, but rather it's an invitation to open our awareness and perception and really to include everything that comes in. All of the ideas in Buddhist practice are just that, practices, things to do, things to work with. So we're not trying to understand equanimity, but rather trying to experience it. We're not trying to understand inclusiveness, but rather we're trying to experience inclusiveness. How do we really welcome everything in? Without wanting to push or pull. One of the ways that we do that is by engaging in that relaxation of the mind, letting the mind take a break, as we heard in our guided meditation, stepping out of the office, maybe opening the window, letting the air come in a little bit, and not needing to organize the pile of papers. Not needing to carve up the world anymore, to just allow it to be. And we can experience that during our meditations, while we're sitting in practice, and we've really removed as much of the busyness of our lives as we can. We can really practice noticing when a thought comes into the mind, or when a sound enters in through the ear and gets translated into the mind. We can watch all of these things and practice equanimity, practice just allowing it to be. And we can watch how quickly we don't practice equanimity, how quickly we say, oh, I don't like that sound, or boy, that bass on that car is really loud as they're cruising by, or whatever it is, or boy, I wish I would have gotten more sleep last night, you know, and kind of dozing off. Any of those things that come up, quickly, want to discriminate against them in our thinking. So meditation is a wonderful place to begin that practice of equanimity, of allowing those experiences to come in. Becomes much more challenging when our eyes are open and we're walking around out there, out in the world, when people say something that ruffles us, when we just feel activated, when we're depleted. So another way of cultivating equanimity is actually engaging with the other practices of the Brahma Vihara, of the four minds of love, and really practicing joy, making sure that we're paying attention to moments of joy, moments of goodness, moments of delight that come into our lives. That's why I shared that story about my child running inside with excitement from the heavy rain and being with friends. And those moments of delight capture us and come inside. And it makes it so we can include the difficult things too. So when our joy is strong, when our sense of seeing others' joy as our own is strong, when we feel that compassion, that that drive to ease suffering, and when we feel kind and loving, loving kindness, when we have that deep felt desire that people might be at peace, they might be at ease and have no obstacles, all of those things come inside. And then when we have a difficulty come in, we have these other practices that are there too. It's not to avoid, not to push this away, but rather to say, like, oh yeah, you're part of this world too. My grief, my anger, my rage, my sorrow, you can come in too, because I have this other thing as well. I have a bad habit of focusing on, well, right there. That's the bad habit. I have a bad habit of focusing on the bad habits. Because it's sometimes it's really compelling to, like, work hard and change things inside and to, you know, shore up these old habits from the past and fix stuff for generations past and generations in the future. It's really easy to think that is the practice. Maybe because we talk about suffering and the causes of suffering and the noble truths. But Thich Nhat Hanh likes to point out that there's an end to suffering. We talk about that as well. And there's a path to ending suffering. He liked to play with those concepts, and he said, maybe we should start with the end of suffering. Maybe that should be the first noble truth. Maybe we should start with joy, with compassion and love. And those practices can be very intentional. We can choose to hold on to those. When those moments of delight come up, instead of passing them by to get onto the next problem to fix, we can take a moment to just be with that delight, to let it in, to let it live inside of us, just as we have all those other things that live inside of us. Not at the expense of suffering, but rather as a way of coming into contact with everything in the world, to really being practicing equanimity, to let it in. And so we just really embody those practices, embody that embody those practices of joy, of loving kindness. I was talking to a friend the other day at work, and said, you know, one of the biggest things that I've found with spiritual practice is that it moved my perception of everything is hard and there are moments of joy to, like, there's everything is joyful and moments of difficulty. So it kind of reset the foundation. So instead of starting from suffering and then looking for joy, it's starting with joy, not maybe looking for suffering, it'll find you. But starting with joy and finding ways to embrace that suffering. It's doesn't mean that I'm happy all the time. Doesn't mean that I'm joyful all the time. But if it feels like that's the needle, that's where the needle returns to, rather than the other way around. It was really a powerful insight. It was my understanding of, it took me a while to understand when Thich Nhat Hanh said that that if you practice continuously, you will have more joy. And I always took that I had to be joyful all the time, but I think that reframing of kind of the foundation of experience, for me, was a much more helpful understanding of that practice, because he wasn't saying you had to be joyful all the time. And as I mentioned with that practice of equanimity, it really includes those other Brahma-viharas, the other foundations, the other minds of love. Because equanimity without loving kindness, without compassion, without joy, is very distant. It's very cold. It might be a relief to our system, especially if we've had a life of strong reactions. It might be a relief to have some coolness around that. But eventually, we'll have to bring the other stuff back in too. We'll have to bring in that connection, that deep warmth around the practice. Because Buddhist teachings really are all interconnected. If we just pull one out and say, like, okay, this is the one that I'm going to do, I'm just going to do equanimity, but we leave out all the other ones, it'll be really hard to engage it, because our idea of what equanimity is without the other practices might not line up with how to really engage, how to really be connected. We see this, I think, a lot with just mindfulness. Mindfulness is pulled out of the Eightfold Path. There's seven other parts of that path. It's not just mindfulness. They're all connected. They all feed and support each other. And so it's totally reasonable to work with and to practice one of the things, but not at the expense of the other ones, to welcome them all in, really, to be inclusive of all the practices together. Mm. When we practice equanimity like this, with that spaciousness, that feeling of space around when something comes in and then what we do with it. Over time, we move closer and closer into that place of joy, of ease, so that we might have a very strong response to something, but it doesn't pull us away. It doesn't make our mind start running away with story and reaction. I think that's the serenity that we might see from somebody who appears equanimous, who is practicing equanimity. They're responding for sure, just not reacting, and choosing love, choosing to respond with love once they've included all of the experience. And sometimes they say that enlightenment or practice is like walking in the mist. You walk for some time and then suddenly notice that you're drenched. And so we might not have an experience right away of joy, or our mind might not switch to loving kindness or compassion as quickly as we want it to. But what we might find is there's a situation that arises that in the past we would have had a strong reaction to, and now we don't. It's gone. It's that suddenly noticing that you're soaked with the practice. And so this inclusiveness, this equanimity, is it really that invitation to leave nothing out, to not pick and choose our experience? So much of our mind is driven by just simple preference, by just things we like. I'm notorious in my family for confusing preference with the way things should be. That's been a powerful practice for me to work with. Like, oh, things are different. My sister-in-law one time said to my brother, she said, I'm not... She said, hold on a second. I'm agreeing with you. I'm just using different words. And that's been a really powerful practice for me, too, to hear where people are agreeing. They just have a different perspective. It's not that we disagree. It's just that we have a different perspective. It's just our preferences are different. And so we really try to leave nothing out, to not push away, not to cling to things, but to welcome it all, to find a foundation of love, of joy, of ease, and to really allow in the grief, the sorrow, the dishes, the play, the delight, to welcome it all, and to breathe, and to let ourselves live deeply, to let life live through us deeply, each moment.